exploration in the second week of discussions about these matters led us to appreciate the Jewish background of our own Christian New Testament, that there too we can deepen our faith by understanding the extent to which spiritually we are all Semites, that Jesus was a Jew who was nurtured by the Hebrew Bible, and that the early Christian community had no Bible, no scripture other than the Hebrew Bible. It was the way in which it came to articulate its own understanding about who Jesus was and is, about who we are as a people, God's chosen people, God's holy people, his holy nation, his royal priesthood. All of these are themes taken from the book of Exodus to express the fact that God's liberating power is ongoing and present and real here and now. The Christian New Testament had to sort out differentiation between Christians and Jews, but that it does not ground an attitude of violence or hostility towards Jews. In the last of these sessions, a day in which we are asked to be aware of gays and lesbians, I would like to make a comment at the outset about the fact that in the Third Reich, when there is no transcendent authority beyond the power of the state is left to engage in lawless authority. It can do anything it wants. If there is no Lord of Israel or no Father of Jesus beyond the power of the law of the state that the Christian may appeal to or that a Jew may appeal to, then the government can do what it pleases. To be sure, in a democratic theory, we want the government to be able to reflect our own desires, and that is one of the great contributions of the modern period of political theory, is that we have an opportunity to participate in a democratic way, to those, at least in a representative way, for those who make decisions that affect our destiny. But when, as in the case of the Third Reich, the public square becomes devoid of all religious content other than the manipulative use of scripture to deceive us into thinking that there are no moments in which we ought to resist the government, then governmental power becomes brutal indeed. As Richard John Neuhaus put it in one of his sentences in the book, The Naked Public Square, the naked public square, that is to say, public discourse that is completely devoid of any religious reference, is a very dangerous place for minorities. Last Monday, we probed the very, very sad story of how Christian hostility culminated in a governmental effort to annihilate the Jews. Today we have an opportunity to reflect on the fact that the raw, brutal governmental power of the Third Reich was directed not only at Jews, but also at gays and lesbians. Jews were ordered to wear a Mogen David, Star of David, the familiar six-pointed star with the word Jew attached to their clothing, so that they would be easy, visible targets for hatred and the like. Gays were ordered to wear a purple triangle or a pink triangle. They too were sent to the death camps. They too were marked out for slaughter. And at the very least, on a day such as this, the opportunity to identify with the suffering of gays as victims of the totalitarian oppression of the Third Reich is a very small step for Christians to appreciate in identifying with their pain and suffering. It may be difficult for many of us to appreciate fully the experience of gays and lesbians if we are not, if we are heterosexual ourselves. On the other hand, it may be one of the ways in which we expand our horizons of understanding of other people. That is one of the gifts of this place, that we come into contact with people of a variety of different views and the like. So I simply wanted to make that statement at the top of the page, that I think the fact that we begin this week with a statement of the power of government vis-a-vis the Jews in the Third Reich, and conclude this week with a memorial of how brutal power can be when it is directed at the sexual minority, namely the homosexuals, that there's a certain parallel in the theme of what government power can be like without limits. And that leads directly to the theme of this conversation. Because in America, we don't spell it with a capital K. We aren't the Third Reich. Whatever flaws and whatever problems exist in the United States, we are a noble experiment in democracy. And part of the nobility of our experiment stems from the fact that right at the beginning, we limited governmental power. We limited it, first of all, in the original document of the Constitution that was written in 1787 by dispersing power, by not concentrating in the hands of anybody. And that seemed very strange to European political theorists at the time. There was only one really significant thinker in Europe, Montesquieu, that would have been delighted with the idea of dividing parliamentary power from that of the monarch. Indeed, we rebel at the very idea of having a king with monarchical authority. And so we remember the American rebellion and statement of independence from King George that precedes the Constitution. But the first moment of our existence, we limit power by dispersing it. We give some power to the legislature, some to the executive, to be sure that the laws that our representatives design are carefully carried out, and some, in a remarkable bold stroke, to judges to tell us whether or not the power of either the legislature or the executive has gotten out of hand. No one person, not even the president, is viewed as someone with supreme authority. We couldn't get in this country an edict that would pass either legal or cultural scrutiny for a long period of time that would single out people for persecution and prosecution. That at least was the theory. The sad history of American practice, however, is to the contrary. There have been targeted persecution of religious minorities in American history, and our representatives have written laws like that. Our executives have carried them out, and our judges have said that there's not a big deal, it's not a big problem. Perhaps the most shameful recent example of that was the executive order of Franklin Delano Roosevelt to remove the Japanese from their home. And I'm talking about people who were born here, people who are natural born citizens of the United States, on the view that they presented a security risk to the nation during World War II. I say it's a shameful episode because it encapsulates the fear that we call xenophobia, or fear of the other, of the alien. It's certainly a tragically unjust result. It was not specifically targeted at any individual that was known to be a spy or something of the sort. A whole group, all Japanese Americans, were lumped together and rounded up and herded into what we would call in Germany a concentration camp, and what we euphemized in this country as a relocation center. But it looked like a concentration camp, and it felt like one to those that lived there. They weren't death camps, but they were concentration camps. They were attempts to concentrate people of a particular race in one place. So I say that at the outset simply to remind us that we need to be careful and we need to be humble about our commitments. We're not there yet. We're not fully the nation that we wish to become. But we have powerful tools available at our disposal for limiting the oppression of minorities by the majority. And the topic that I chose is to explore what the Constitution says about prayer in the government's schools. We ought not to assume that the government should be in the business of having schools. At least we ought to note historically at the outset that when the word school was used, you won't find it in the American Constitution because there weren't any government schools. All schools were religious schools, or all schools were schools operated in a home or in a small group of families getting together to teach their children to read by reading the Bible or learning the ABCs and the ways that, that people did. The government didn't operate a series of schools. The big universities of the East Coast, for example, Harvard, Yale, William and Mary, Penn, all of these were religiously oriented schools. Indeed, they were kind of seminaries. The drift away from that history is pretty easy to trace in the motto of Harvard University. Originally, it was Pro Christi Veritate, on behalf of the truth of Christ. And then, in a more enlightened age, they dropped the Pro Christi bit and just made it Veritas, or truth. And when, about 15 years ago, Harvard dropped the requirement that an undergraduate at Harvard College had to take Latin, one wag decided that they should just say truth, but put it in the three shields, T-R-U-T-H, because no Harvard students wouldn't be able to translate the Latin word Veritas anymore. In any event, it's clear that we don't associate Harvard with being a congregational establishment. But that's exactly what was going down in Massachusetts at the time preceding our Constitution. There were a variety of established churches, and we need to know something a little bit about that before we discuss the issue of religion in our public schools. Why? Because the First Amendment to our Constitution, the first liberty protected in the Bill of Rights, talks about an establishment of religion. It also talks about free exercise of religion. The word religion only occurs once, and then there's these two ways of describing it. It's put in the negative, Congress shall enact no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The rest of the First Amendment goes on to describe political freedoms such as freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, freedom to petition the government for redress of grievance. So these political freedoms are conjoined with religious freedom right at the outset, the head of our civil liberties. But what was meant by an established religion in both colonial America and in Tudor and Stuart England, the period of the monarchy, roughly from Henry VIII down to Queen Anne and King George, it begins the Hanoverian line, was that there was a church state that everybody had to belong to in order to be part of the political apparatus of the day. You had to pay for the ministers of religion in that church. The Church of England, by law established, meant that each village had its parish that was part of the operation of the government. There was loyalty to the crown that was expected to be forthcoming from these institutions. And there was a way in which everybody had to attend the church or be found subject to fines and the like. You couldn't hold office if you were not a member of that church. You couldn't vote. You were indeed in some of the legislation sent beyond the village, at least 5 miles away, sort of enforced suburbanization of Roman Catholics, their chance to get with the later model of suburban success, of fleeing the city. It was not a voluntary matter. They were uprooted and their property was forfeited. And so the idea was that civil liberties were lost as a consequence of religious conviction. That's the conjunction between establishment of religion and free exercise of religion that our framers in the First Amendment sought to repudiate. They wanted to say that in order to promote religious freedom or free exercise of religion, according to the dictates of conscience of each believer, we wouldn't allow the new national government to establish any one church, no national religion. No one church could be preferred or set up or established in such a way as to diminish the political rights of non-members of that church. Ironically, the church that the people in Philadelphia were worried about, well, does anybody know that? What group do you think they were afraid of? The Congregationalists in New England, or the Episcopalians in Virginia and the Southern colonies, or the Southern states, we have to say, at this period? It would be likely they'd be afraid of them.
Maybe the
Catholics, yeah. The Roman Catholics. You know how many Roman Catholics there were in the United States at that time? 1%.
Rhode Island?
1% of the population were Roman Catholics. Were they afraid of Little Rhodey? Rhode Island, this strange Baptist experiment in which everybody's religious convictions can matter. What religious group could possibly emerge in Rhode Island that would be a distinctive power force oppressing minorities?
How about Roger Williams' group?
Well, that's Rhode Island. Roger Williams was the one who was left Massachusetts Bay and went down to Narragansett Bay to set up what the experiment known as Little Rhodey, in which anybody's religious convictions could go. But we're now up into the end of the 18th century, and 1787 in Philadelphia, they get the Constitution Amendment, and now they get a first Congress, the first time people are sent to the new National Congress, and they've got petitions from the various state legislatures saying, if you want to get this new national government going, you've got to make sure that there's a Bill of Rights, and you've got to attend to this issue of an established religion. So I'm asking, well, which religion were they afraid of? In fact, they had let the state of Massachusetts continue with their Congregationalist establishment. We now call it the United Church of Christ, but in those days it was called the Congregationalist Church. It was the Quakers, of all things. They were worried that in the new relationships with Canada, there wouldn't be enough military clout to keep the British Empire from either A, infiltrating, or B, doing the overt declared war that they eventually did in the War of 1812. This tiny little group of friends posed, it's the mouse that roared sort of syndrome. Here's this tiny little group of pacifists who, by virtue of their religious convictions, they were afraid would infiltrate into the government, into the new national government, which was located at Philadelphia, and cause us to become a pacifist nation. And so one of the motivating forces was to make sure that that didn't happen, that we would always be, militarily prepared to deal with the Canadians. Or think of Ronald Reagan's examples of being militarily at the ready against the Sandinistas and their famous threat to the well-being of the United States. And every time the White House put out a statement about the march from Managua to wherever, say Brownsville, Texas, or worse yet, the soft underbelly of Malibu, the march got shorter. But the threat didn't get more plausible. It's just that that's part and parcel of the mind of what's going on, is that military necessities are creating these kinds of concerns. And so we'll allow for freedom of conscience by Quakers, Mennonites, and other types by giving statutes that says you don't have to serve in the military, but we're not going to let your views become prevailing. Now, fill in the blanks with any other religious group. Imagine something of the difficulties that Baptists had at the hands of Episcopalians in Virginia. The Episcopalians want to follow a particular book of worship. They want to be sure as to who's preaching what, and so they start handing out licenses to preach. Well, that runs clean contrary to the Baptist free church tradition conviction that Well, maybe you're going to preach on Sunday, or maybe you, but, you know, in any event, we'll decide that in the local congregation. It doesn't need a lot of hierarchical apparatus of a bishop or a superintendent or a synod or anything like that. We're just, you and I are going to decide who's going to preach next Sunday. In that kind of a setup, it's oppressive to Baptists to have the trappings of governmental power and authority behind the concept of who shall preach. And so for them, the licensing of preachers in Virginia was right at the heart of this controversy over religious freedom at the outset. It was also a problem as to who should pay for the teacher of religion in the village. And that's the famous controversy between an Episcopalian governor by the name of Patrick Henry. We all remember "Give me liberty or give me death" speech in Richmond at the outbreak of the American Revolution. But he's also known for proposing an idea that, look, in order to make this new experiment work, the American reality work, we can't let kids grow up without knowing the difference between right and wrong. We need civic virtue. We need what was called Republican virtue, caring for the other, not just the lowest common denominator of obeying the speeding laws or something like that, but really genuinely caring for the others in the village. And in order to do that, you need some instruction, some education about that. But remember, the only schools that there are Christian schools. He's called, in the person is in this document is called a teacher of Christian religion, and I use the pronoun he advisedly. Women didn't undertake that role except in the home. They were all male teachers, and male teachers of what religion? That's the problem for a Baptist, is that if you pay to the village for a teacher of Christian religion, it's going to be some kind of Episcopal version of it. Episcopalians will predominate. Why? Because they are the most numerous group in Virginia. So they fight that battle out. And James Madison writes an elegant memorial, a document that remonstrates, that protests against this idea that even a small tax is too much. That's the whole background of what was going on in America at the time. Protection of free speech and other political liberties is conjoined with religious liberty to make sure that the national government, at least, doesn't do anything to interfere with religious freedom or with political speech. Now, there's another move that we need to make to understand the problem of public school and religions today, and that is that although the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law, it's a limit on the national government, after the Civil War, the 14th Amendment says no state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So in this century, beginning in 1925, and if for purposes of the Religion Clause in 1940, the Supreme Court in Washington looked at this word, liberty, in the 14th Amendment and said, well, we'll use this word to embrace all of the stuff in the First Amendment, and we'll get religious freedom as one of the liberties that is protected against state intrusion as well as federal intrusion. Before that, it was theoretically possible. Indeed, it was historically the case that Massachusetts had its established religion right down till 1833. And that was no problem. In fact, the whole idea was to protect federalism, that no one state should be told how to do its business, that they'd be free to do that. After this shift of interpretation that arose by virtue of the deep, profound mistrust of state government because of the Civil War, the national government set limits on what states could do. Didn't trust that to the process of the state constitutions. In the same period, however, the state constitutional process was deeply affected by the federal grant of coming into the Union here in the West, not just the state of Washington, but virtually every state west of the Mississippi that was a federal territory that was admitted after the Civil War was affected by a senator from New York by the name of Blaine. He tried to get the federal constitution amended so that no teaching of religion could ever occur in any school. In any school. He was unsuccessful. He would get a majority of the votes in the House, one session, and then couldn't persuade the senators, and they drop it for that session. And then he'd persuade the senators, but the House at that point say, well, we think this is a kooky idea. So he was unable to modify or to amend the federal constitution, but he knew how to wield power. He became chairman of the Territorial Committee, and so he said to Utah and to Washington and to Idaho, to the representatives that came from these new places, you may become a part of the new federal union if you put into your state charter, into your state constitution, a little paragraph I'll give you. And then they'd meet over lunch and he'd give them the Blaine Amendment. And they'd stick that in as a required condition of coming into the federal union. So there are many different documents that are in play when we discuss this issue of whether or not prayer in schools is a good idea or a bad idea, according to which document. It may be a problem under a state constitution as well as under the federal constitution. I think that's plenty for deep background, historical stuff. Let's cut to the chase now and look at what the question looks like in the late 20th century when the question arose. All through roughly the 1840s up to the present, we have schools beginning to multiply and proliferate throughout the United States as part of the enterprise of what government does. It's probably one of the most obvious thing you think of after police and fire protection of what local government does, is it has schools. But that's what your property taxes goes for, is to do schools. Doesn't matter whether you're a user, whether you have kids in those schools or not. You could be single or not have children, or maybe you've had children but they've left the nest and they're out somewhere else and they're not using the schools. You still pay for them. It's just as you pay for fire protection whether your house burns down or not. You want it to be there. That was not always the case, as I said from the beginning, and one of the things that we ought to question about these schools in the 19th century is whether they were free from religious instruction. In fact, they weren't. The Bible was read every day, and the Bible was read, as I've suggested in the last 2 weeks, in a way that was inimical and hostile to Jews. It was a seed ground for Protestant Christianity. It was also read in a way that was inimical and hostile to Roman Catholics. Surprise, surprise, those two groups start developing their own schools, so-called parochial schools. The first two groups to do it in any significant numbers were Jews and Catholics, or the Hebrew day schools and the Roman Catholic parochial school. You think of how the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and the Seventh-day Adventists and all sorts of other religious groups started up their own schools too. It arose out of a problem about the kind of religious instruction that was going on in so-called common school. It was common for purposes of Protestant hegemony and Protestant ideas of what Christian religion was all about, but it wasn't common to people who were on the outside of reading the same stories. Remember when we saw the Binding of Isaac story or the Passover story, that can either be, I mean, can be interpreted very sympathetically to Jews, or it can be interpreted negatively and harmfully towards Jews. And Jews were quick to perceive that, just as Catholics were. There was also a movement both among Jews and among Roman Catholics to get along with and collaborate with the public schools, sort of not to be having these wearying battles. You find that already as early as 1890. But again, let's cut to the modern period. Against that whole background of the complex character of what is schooling and who's doing it and why, we have a series of cases brought in the early 1960s challenging whether or not religious instruction ought to go on in the government schools. The first one dealt with a relatively easy question, but I'll just put it to you and see what you make of it. Should the government compose prayers, write prayers, for daily use in public schools? That's the question. Does that pose the threat of establishing a religion? Either recalling some of the historical characteristics of an established church that I referred to, What's the problem if the government, your local school board, starts writing a prayer for recitation by children? Please.
Well, it probably, maybe it's not your view.
Okay.
So it would be a different
now view. Say I'm the school board guy, I'm the head of the school board, and I hear you, you come in and you protest about this, that your views are going to be offended. I would say, okay, let's take that into account. Let's write the prayer in such a way that you don't get offended. And you sign off on it and say, yep, okay, that's good with me. Did his objection go away?
And it becomes real watered down
after. Ah, that's the point, is that he's not going to be the only one that will show up with an objection.
40 splinter groups.
There are going to be 40 other groups. That's the experience of American religion, is that we take the worst aspects of church and conviction about the gospel and the sect in Europe and combine them into an American denomination and get the more the merrier. So there are going to be all kinds of people reading into this prayer, an offense, a hurt, or whatever, or say, hey, that's not my doctrine, that's not my dogma, that's not my conviction, so how dare you impose that on my little children? And that's a kind of a very influential, formative age. I will never forget the day that my youngest daughter, Deirdre, came back from public school, her first day in school, and said, Daddy, I learned a new prayer. I said, oh, what was this prayer you learned, Deirdre? And she very proudly clamped her hand over her heart and said, I pledge allegiance to the United States. And she got it. It's right. You know, that's a form of devotion. And you know, for those of you who are Canadians, that's a pledge of allegiance to our flag that offends the Jehovah's Witnesses. And we allow them exemptions, but the little Catholic girls in public school don't get an exemption. They have to stand up and do this quote prayer. Well, I think you expressed it extremely well, is that it waters prayer down to the point where it is the lowest common denominator and it's no longer prayer. Oh God, if you are, help me out if you can. That's not prayer. That's not the Psalms. That's not the kind of prayer, at least, that we looked at last Saturday as the kind of deep communal experience of faith. Please.
Are you not saying that children are required to say the Pledge of Allegiance in the schools?
I'm saying that they are required to do so.
They are not in the state of Washington.
Well, okay, good for you. It's a state-by-state matter. It's a school board-by-school board matter. And even in places where there is no theoretical requirement, in fact, children are put through all kinds of peer pressure to go along and conform. Think of the enormous advantage to George Bush in bashing Mike Dukakis on that issue 4 years ago. It's just one of those easy wins for a demagogue. The flag, I mean, my goodness, there is no national symbol of unity more sacred, quote unquote, to many Americans than the flag. And if you even begin to suggest a religious conviction as an exemption from saluting the flag, well, let me tell you that what that meant for Jehovah's Witnesses in the 1940s was that these little children would be beat up in the schoolyard. And it meant that mob justice, vigilante justice, accompanied with the power of the sheriff, would go either haul Jehovah's Witnesses out of their home and flagellate them and beat them up with full blessings of the local sheriffs and the like. This was the stuff that was going on in the early 1940s in this country, and the deep background of why the Supreme Court in 1943 said, as a matter of free speech principles, we're not going to require the Jehovah's Witnesses to stand up and engage in this exercise. But I can tell you that as of the 1980s in Indiana, at least, I represented a couple of Jehovah's Witnesses in Indiana, and the sledding was still very, very rough. And it's not because of some formal law on the books, it's because of the common attitudes in the culture that how dare you not conform. And that might give you some insight of what religion in the public school looks like to a Jew. It's going to look like Christian faith. It's going to look like the imposition of our doctrines and our tenets of faith. Hence, for a variety of reasons, Jews joined the civil liberties unions and others in forming a challenge to these laws. And the first one, known as Engel against Vitale, challenged a school board prayer composed by the regents of the state of New York that was a kind of a now I lay me down to sleep or inoffensive type prayer. Inoffensive? To whom? Inoffensive. To atheists? Is that a problem? I guess at the time, in 1962, there weren't many atheists in America, at least not many people who would answer a question about this matter in the affirmative. Now, since 1962, this sort of null set, as a sociologist would call them, people that don't show up in any one of the other categories, turns out to be a very large and expanding group. It's kind of leveled off, and it's still hovering in the last 5 years at around 12%. But that's a very big change from 1962, when they were about 2%. So that's at least one group about whom one might have a concern of majority oppressing a minority. What about Buddhists, who form a larger slice of the population of our most recent state, Hawaii, than do Christians, than do any single Christian group? What about Muslims, who are more numerous in this country than Episcopalians? When I saw that statistic, I was really shocked, because I've just got used to Episcopalians as, you know, the people with influence, clout, and power in America, who are the captains of industry and make things hum. But they are a declining church group, and Muslims are an ascending church group or religious group. So in short, the complexity of the diversity, the cultural diversity of modern America, makes us question, well, should the government be in the business of writing prayers? But I think the most telling objection is yours, is that it ruins prayer. It's shoddy prayer when you go for the lowest common denominator and try to figure out what will work for everybody. You get pablum, you don't get prayer. The court, I think, was on pretty safe and easy grounds when it ruled then, in the Engel case, that such an exercise of government power is unlawful, is unconstitutional. And that was 1962. Now, supposing those of you that heard Fred Nieder and myself yesterday on the Lord's Prayer, I think, could come away from that session saying, well, that's not pablum. That's a pretty good prayer. It's a prayer that the Jews could authentically pray. It's a prayer that arises out of the Hebrew Bible. It's shot through with the piety of Jewish prayer life and spirituality in Palestine at the time of Jesus. So it's a prayer that Jews could authentically pray without making it refer to all kinds of Christian doctrines. But get real here. Get real. The Lord's Prayer is the central prayer of Christians. Jesus has given us this prayer, and it's become the badge of our tribe. So just telling Jews, well, what problem do you have praying the Lord's Prayer? Doesn't answer the cultural or political question for Jews. And hence the second case that the court took to look at this issue a year later ruled that you couldn't pray the Lord's Prayer or read the Bible in a public school for devotional purposes without violating the prohibition against an established religion. Now, does that mean you can't teach about religion? You can't have a course on world religions in which you look at Islam and Judaism and Christianity and Buddhism and what have you? No, not at all. Does it mean you can't study, I don't know, Shakespeare or Milton, or in which obvious references to the Bible occur and discuss them? Not at all. You can study the Bible as literature. You can study religion as a social phenomenon, and indeed to edit our history books in such a way that I literally have kids in law school at Valparaiso University who don't know that Martin Luther King was a Baptist preacher. It's shocking, perhaps, to those of us that were, you know, alive and well in the days when he was preaching, but that's the phenomenon that I experience as an educator, is that I have people in graduate school that have gone through a kind of a pablum approach to history in which they just, everything religious gets edited out because of this case, the Shem case. It's a mistaken interpretation of that case. It oughtn't to be, but I'm just telling you, if you look at some of the textbooks in some of the jurisdictions in California, somebody made a comment about California earlier, I might say that it is, in my opinion, leading the way to towards a more sane approach to how to incorporate religion in the curriculum, to, in doing it in a way that is not an imposition, not a coercive laying of religious convictions upon people. Leo Pfeffer always used to tell, the famous Jewish advocate of this viewpoint that we ought to get religion out of public schools, he always used to tell this story about a little Jewish child when the Christians, in effect, opened up their Bibles for their Bible study at whatever, you know, 8:30 in the morning, first thing in the class, is the little Jewish child would be literally locked in a closet in a dark space, sent, you know, in all the horror of the ghetto, of putting the Jew in his place, sort of thing. Well, I mean, that story, whether or not it happened, I never pushed Leo on that very hard, I don't know. But it's one of those stories that, even if imaginary, makes the point that, say, the child is not locked up in a closet, but is there in the room. Isn't there a kind of a dimension of intrusion on religious conscience that occurs when you have to be there to fulfill some compulsory school attendance law, or you have to be in an alternative school, one or the other? Let me just, in passing, say that the state just south of us, state of Oregon, in the 1920s, tried to do away with all of the alternative schools. It was a plot that was notoriously and viciously anti-Catholic in all the propaganda and literature that was, you know, scattered all around Oregon. By surprise, surprise, one of the worst offenders of hate speech in American history, the Ku Klux Klan. And they literally tried to shut down all of the religious schools. Now, who would lose in that is not just the Catholics and the Lutherans and the, you know, the religious groups that operate alternative schools, but the little children who go to the government schools and who get the doctrinaire indoctrination of whatever the government wishes to put out as truth. That's the problem. If there's no escape valve, no alternative, then we're truly in trouble. Well, the Supreme Court invalidated that in 1925 in the case known as Pierce against the Society of Sisters of the Holy Name of Jesus. Nuns running a Catholic parochial school won that case 9-0. But were it not for that case, a case in which I might point out the American Jewish Committee started its long and distinguished record of entering documents in the Supreme Court as friends of the court to persuade the court to move in a certain direction. And the Jews were on record right then as saying, boy, if religious freedom means anything, is that you have to have an alternative to the government schools. You can't close down all of the alternative religious schools. Now, things were kind of blew up at the time of Schempp and Engel, largely among Protestant Christians, although Cardinal Spellman in New York also issued a blistering attack on the Supreme Court. And this led to a series of movements to amend the Constitution to provide that it's okay to have religious instruction in public schools. Just put those words in the Constitution, and then, well, you know, what court could do anything with those words after that? It would answer the question differently if you just changed the text of the Constitution. None of those efforts succeeded any more than the Blaine Amendment did in the federal constitution in the 19th century. But it was a kind of a gathering force for a lot of blowing off of steam and anger at the court for this outrageous opinion, according to some, that you couldn't even read the Bible in schools. What were schools for if you couldn't read the Bible there? Well, I guess one of the things that we've become sensitive to in the last week and a half here is that how you read the Bible and in what community and in what context will determine the meaning that any given text has. You can read it in a way, well, we've already been over that. Although those constitutional amendments failed, there was a lot of discussion at the local school board level about what to do about these cases. And who here, I'll have to ask the non-Canadians, although perhaps you get American television, so you undoubtedly know of the Miranda case. Does that case mean anything to anybody here?
Reading of the rights.
And that, was that popular with police chiefs when it came down in 1967?
No.
No. Yeah. Anybody remember the impeachment award billboards? There was deep trouble for the court because of that opinion. It was soft on crime and that sort of stuff. What time are we at, Earl?
It's at 11:30.
11:30, good, we have 15 minutes, we can do it. Far more angry than the response to Miranda and the cases like it that in effect applied the 14th Amendment due process clause, not just to the First Amendment, but to the Fourth Amendment right against self-incrimination, Sixth Amendment right to counsel. It was a kind of a logical coherence to what the Warren Court was doing. It just said the same text, no state shall deprive any person of life, liberty, or property, means that we have to do all of the Bill of Rights, or at least one at a time, apply them to the states. And that's what the beef was about. And you may remember it was a really angry time. Well, let me tell you, the civil disobedience, the manifest contempt for the court in its opinions was nothing in the criminal procedure area compared to the flagrant and outright violation of these cases by school boards all over America. They just said, well, the Supreme Court can say that garbage if it wants, but we're going to do, we're going to do education and truth and consequences in New Mexico the way we know it to be done, or Abilene, Kansas, or wherever else. Huge, massive protests that eventually wound up in school board meetings and school board elections and the like, that just in effect thumbed the nose of the Supreme Court. It was those two opinions were among the most widely disregarded opinions of modern Supreme Court history. We're now at a moment, though, when we're not involved in those kind of argumentative controversy, then we can look back and say, yeah, I think the court got it about right, that we shouldn't imposed religious instruction in a way that it goes to the heart of little youngsters at a point where the parents really have little opportunity to correct the impressions that are taken about Jesus Christ or whatever. At least I think that's the general sense among the people, not just among the legal scholars, but among the people in most of the opinion polls that I've been following on this theme. Well, if the government can't compose prayers, and some WAC has said that as long as the government insists on doing math exams in its schools, there will be prayer in public schools. What about silent prayer, quiet prayer? For example, if I were to tell you all right now, we're going to take the next 15 seconds of our session in quiet. So let's try that. Earl, you let us know when it's moved.
Bing.
I thought of all sorts of things for which I, not only can be grateful, but am grateful to God for coming here and learning things here. Maybe some of you started humming How Great Thou Art, or for all I know, or maybe you had sexual fantasies, or isn't it nicer that it's cool in here instead of hot like yesterday? Who knows what you thought? I didn't tell you what to think. I didn't tell you how to think. I just said we're going to have some quiet time. So I suppose under those circumstances, it would be less coercive and less suggestive if saying, now listen, children, before we start up today, I think we all need some quiet time. Put your pencils down. Stop rattling around. We're just going to take some quiet time. I hardly think that establishes any religious viewpoint. And I think that the Supreme Court has given a clue, but not yet its blessing, or whatever, to moments of silence. But I think that probably is going to fall into the permissible zone, just as the teaching about religion is in the permissible zone. What to do about spoken prayers? Are they never to occur in a public school curriculum? We have a case that the Supreme Court heard last October called Lee against Wiseman, involving two Jews. Deborah Wiseman is a graduate of a middle school, and Lee is the head of the public school district, but the other Jew on the other side of the case is a rabbi who was invited to school for this once a year event of commencement, in which he prayed as a rabbi would, a bracha, a blessing that basically goes this way, and I wish I had brought along the text of his prayer, but I don't, but I'll give you the drift of it. If I said, land of the free and home of the brave, what allusion would I be making?
Not a political, but a...
You ever sung those verses before? You know, yeah. Never sung those words before.
America
the Beautiful.
Yeah, America the Beautiful.
Land of the free and home of the brave. That's
not religious. Yeah, right.
Okay, so I could say in a setting, land of the free and home of the brave. Supposing I said, God of the free and hope of the brave. Just change one letter in home, make it hope of the brave. And say, God of the free, invoking the memory of liberation, Exodus, whatever. I mean, Jews will read that in one way, others will read it in another way. But supposing I said that, God of the free, hope of the brave, look upon these children gathered here today and give them respect for the institutions of freedom that we enjoy in this society. Make them grateful for the teachers that have enabled them to read and know something about the society in which they live. This is not like a daily drill. Like, once a year, this rabbi shows up and says those things. Is that establishing a religion?
Yeah.
Well, that's exactly what the court is going to resolve for us between now and the 4th of July, when the court always goes its way for the summer recess. And it always clears up its cases by that time. Under an aptly styled, sorry, go ahead. Go.
I was going to, in, my husband brought in the PI from yesterday or the day before, and
it's been decided.
5-4 ruling that it was not legal to not
it's unconstitutional. Okay. So we now have a ruling from the Supreme Court that says that this prayer is unconstitutional. I suppose the easy way to find an accommodation, you know, like the moment of silence, is say, well, why don't we have the commencement exercise at 5 o'clock tonight or at 7:30 when, you know, when more working parents can be there. But at a separate time in the day, let's say at 3 o'clock after school hours, we're going to have a baccalaureate. And it's going to be in the Cathedral of St. John the Divine 1 year and in the First United Methodist Church the next year and in the Temple Bethel the next year. We rotated around and anybody that wants to come can come. Now have we violated the Constitution? Clearly not. Why? Because it's a voluntary, free exercise of religion. Anybody can come that wants to. But at the ceremony in which kids get their diploma, to insert religious meaning into that is presumably now thought by a slim majority of the court, 5-4, to be offensive. Would Martin Luther King, for example, have violated the Constitution? Fortunately, nobody litigated this question. In his dream speech, it's on federal property, it's in the, right there at the Lincoln Memorial. Or would we require him to edit it a little, say, free at last, thank the President of the United States, I'm free at last.
Nobody forced anyone to listen to that.
Ah, but it's a use of federal property. It's a park. Yeah?
Presidents say God on the similar federal property.
Every president since George Washington has invoked God in his inaugural address. Every single one.
Well, our seal
even the
says
most cynical,
God
like
trust.
Thomas Jefferson, sorry?
Our seal says, in God we trust.
In God we trust. That's itself a separate...
We're going to have to change that. I guess if the Supreme Court had anything to do with it, they would have to change that.
Okay, please.
We had an exchange student who was with us from Greece, and he said there was a mistake in that, in God we trust. They left out the L. It should be in gold.
Oh, in gold, yeah, right. Yeah, in gold we trust. Yeah. Or which God? Is it Mammon, or is it the... Father Abraham and Sarah, and so on. Yeah?
Well, doesn't the Supreme Court just interpret the rules and the laws?
Well, it does so with lots of documents in play, namely the federal constitution, the state statute or practice before it as a result of the 14th Amendment, or the state constitution itself. It has lots of documents in play. And. Yeah, it's always in an interpretive process, much as we were engaged in an interpretive process by reading various stories from the scripture. Mm-hmm. But we saw that they meant something very different to different people in different times and different places. Indeed, that the Bible was composed for different communities in different times and different places. And that we should expect that of our constitutional texts as well. We're winding down on time, but the reason why I suggested a baccalaureate exercise would not violate the Constitution is that there is a clear guideline from the Supreme Court that government property may be used for religious purposes when those who are gathering in the space are doing so on their own and in a voluntary way. For example, when the Pope came to the United States, he celebrated the Mass in the same park that Martin Luther King gave that famous speech at. Nobody seriously thought that Madeline Mary O'Hare was going to win her lawsuit, but she went to court to try to enjoin the Pope from doing that prayer. Those of you that keep up with the Murray family may know that her son has become a devout evangelical Christian, presumably because he couldn't stand the silence after sneezes. But here's what the court said about this matter. Back in 1980, in a case known as Widmar against Vincent, a group of evangelical Christians at the University of Missouri in Kansas City decided that they wanted to have some place to meet and study the Bible and worship God. The dean of students, a fellow by the name of Dean Widmar, said no. Why? Because two reasons. We would be spending money if we turned the lights on in the room or put the janitor in afterwards to sweep up after you, and that would be state funds for a religious purpose, and that would be a violation of the Establishment Clause. So the kids are, you know, they go back and they ponder that some, and they say, well, okay, can we meet on the lawn? And then we won't turn lights on and we won't have a janitor problem. It won't be a funding problem, won't be a money problem. Can we do that? And now he's really forced to give a reason different to the earlier one. So he says, no, you can't meet on campus. Why? Because if I say yes, then it will be perceived by everybody. There'll be this common perception out there that what I'm doing is endorsing religion. I'm promoting religion. As dean of students, I'm allowing a religious group to meet on campus. The same campus that had been dragged into court kicking and screaming to allow the Students for a Democratic Society, the kind of radical lefty group of the 60s, to meet on campus. Didn't want those kids to meet on campus at all. Same university that had been dragged kicking and screaming into court on Gay Awareness Day, I have to say this, in opposition to any gay student organization. They were required by the Constitution to allow these students. So now the court was in a kind of a dilemma, having said, free speech theory, well, I've erased the First Amendment part, but it goes this way. That there's religious freedom and then there's political freedom. Now, on free speech grounds and association ideas that groups can meet, assembly, they had said yes to the Students for a Democratic Society, kind of a radical political group, and they had said yes to the Gay Students Organization, the GSO. But now they found themselves in the ironic position that the only people who couldn't use the campus for a purpose of a discussion of their ideas were religious people. And when that got up to the Supreme Court of the United States, the Supreme Court ruled 8-1 that was nonsense. That you can't discriminate against the discussion of religion on a voluntary basis in governmentally owned property. The next and last part of this story just involves whether or not that rule, which sounds pretty sensible when you think about it, that there shouldn't be discrimination of that sort, should be limited to university students or could also extend to high school students. And that raged for about 10 years between 1980 and 1990 around a second factual question. Is, are high school students dumb or smart? And that was the factual question that tore the country apart in that decade. The answer is you know, I guess those of you that have had teenagers will know that they don't sort of have inquisitive, inquiring minds on the day that they enter college and no questions to put to you. Before that, you know, that they're just docile, receptive, oh, gee, that's swell, sort of idea. It's just the most naive, incredible depiction of teenagers. But that's exactly what every federal court of appeals did with that question. It said, because teenagers are so, docile, they will just accept the idea that if the high school allows a Christian group to meet on campus to discuss the Bible after school hours, either, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning before school begins or at 3 o'clock in the afternoon after school is out, if we allow these kids to meet on the high school campus, then what these stupid people all around us are going to believe is that the principal is requiring people to go to that group. So Congress intervened and wrote a statute known as the Equal Access Act, saying, if you allow non-curricular groups to meet in the public school after hours or before hours or whatever else, a chess club, a ski club, a this or that, Dungeons and Dragons club, all the various non-curricular groups to meet. And by non-curricular, what I mean is a group for which you don't get a grade. Okay? And maybe there's a public school teacher there to the extent of determining that kids aren't going to break the windows or do some vandalism or something like that. But a student-led, student-initiated group for, let's say, young Democrats, young Republicans, young this, young that, then the principle of the Widmar case applies to high schools as well. And Congress wrote that into a federal statute. It says any school which receives federal funds must allow these students to meet on these conditions of equality of access to the facility. And the short answer on any school that receives federal funds is virtually everybody. So it was a way of writing a national rule. The last story, and that rule was sustained by the Supreme Court in 1990, 2 years ago, by a vote of 8-1. The last dimension is this blame thing that I mentioned at the outset. Why? Because one of these Equal Access Act cases, after the Mergens case, was sent back to the Washington State Court, to the federal court, but to determine the issue of whether or not the Washington State Constitution constitutes another block on the road to the meeting of these children in their own public school to discuss the Bible. I represent those students, and I represented some students in the 11th Circuit in a case in Georgia. I lost the 11th Circuit one, and I think we'll win this one here, that the state constitution does not constitute an obstacle to prayer of this sort, which is genuinely voluntary, not the kind that was discussed in the constitutional amendment phase between 1963. They talk about voluntary prayer, which can be an illusion. How voluntary is the prayer of a child who is required to be there? Again, put yourself in the perspective of the Jewish parent, having your child there as, you know, subjecting that child to Christian instruction is not a thoughtful use of our constitutional mandate to avoid establishment. So that's where we are. Prayers in silence that are in moments of time, maybe it's a prayer, maybe it's something else, who knows what, that would be permissible. Prayer on a voluntary basis that is in a group that is led by students, that is initiated by students, and that's just using the government facility on an equal basis with other non-religious or philosophical groups alike, that would be okay. But not prayer that is expressly aimed to shape devotion of minds and hearts towards a common God, because we don't have one in America. Please. That's already contemplated in the statute and is not a problem under the law. But do you think that it creates a problem that if a teacher is there, then all the kids will say, oh, geez, I better show up because Teacher Smith is there?
No, I'm just imagining, are you going to pay a teacher then? I mean, in our district, anybody who takes on those clubs and so forth gets a stipend for doing that. Are we as taxpayers then going to give stipends
sure,
to
why
teachers
not?
To stay?
Because they're not being paid to lead a prayer group. They're being paid to look after the property.
Just to be like babysitters.
Yeah. We're out of time for the tape, but again, I'm happy to stay on and discuss these matters with anybody that wishes to.
What about Christmas programs?
Christmas carols. There are two cases that deal with the holiday of Christmas, and they do so with respect to symbols in public places rather than express issue of singing carols. We ought not to be fooled into thinking that the term neutrality solves these problems. To call it the winter solstice holiday is not neutral. It's simply to return to a pagan way of thinking about cycles and seasons. It is terribly significant in Christian history that our ancestors in Israel shot a religious meaning into holidays that were already existing in Canaan when they got there. They gave to the situation of unleavened bread and of the lamb separate holiday two historic references to Passover. So did Jesus when he took over the Passover meal and then gave it the meaning of that we as Christians celebrate in Eucharist. So did the Christians of the 4th century when they sort of came out from a position of being small and persecuted. And so all the national holidays of the winter solstice going on, and there was no Christmas then. We don't have any date for the birth of Jesus in the New Testament. They didn't think that that was a very important detail. But they appropriated a pagan light festival in the wintertime and said, well, we'll give it a different meaning. We'll call it Christ the Light of the World. We'll say that his birth gives light and grace to all peoples. And hence the shifting back and forth between existing holidays and giving them religious meaning is something that's part of our history. Now, in America, Christmas clearly had a religious meaning in the 19th century. To suggest that it does for America today is, I think, maybe it does for your family, and maybe the way you do it is by having a season of anticipation, Advent, in which you set aside money for the poor people of the world and buy one another a rather modest present. The way we do it in my family, for example, is that none of the adults give gifts to one another. We give gifts to the kids. We want it to be a joyful occasion for them. But whether it's the Catholic Worker or the United Farm Workers or the now certainly Holden Villages can enter into the horizon of my gifts, we give to one another as adults something that really has something to do with the birth of Christ, the Light of the World, instead of, overextending the plastic and making life miserable for everybody in January and February, which is the usual business as usual in America, is that it go on a buying binge in December. And to get there, to motivate you to buy more, stores will put up all kinds of symbols that this is the time when we are counting on you to buy. Now, the court gets this case about the city of Pawtucket, Rhode Island, setting up some Christmas symbols. And it says, oh yeah, that's okay. There's a nativity scene with Mary and Joseph and the shepherds and so forth and the baby Jesus. That's okay, why? Because it's surrounded by a plastic reindeer and a sugar cane call and a live wishing well and four or five other things that are secular in context, which has now been called by constitutional scholars the three plastic reindeer rule. If you strip Christmas of its truly Christian associations, then the court says that's okay, that's not an establishment of religion. 4 years later, it deals with the same kind of nativity scene, but in the city of Pittsburgh, and tastefully decorated by evergreens and poinsettias. No reindeer, no Santa Claus, no wishing well, no candy canes, none of that. Ah, that's offensive, it says, because that's religious. And worse yet is that in the same case, the menorah, because there's a division among the Jews in America as to whether or not to say, get all of the religious symbols out of the public space, or, well, if you're going to have Christian ones there, let's have a Jewish one there too. And so some Jews say, well, we ought to put up a menorah. The court says, the menorah is no problem. Why? Because everybody knows the Jews don't believe in that the menorah is a religious symbol. It's just an excuse to go buy stuff in December and, keep up with the Joneses, keep up with the Christians. Because we'll put blue and silver in our boxes instead of green and red, but it's just a buying binge thing for Jews. Mm-hmm. Now that is the worst of all possible worlds for both Jews and Christians. Our Christian faith in Jesus, the incarnate Word of God, is stripped of all religious significance and theological significance. And Jews' faith in the religious liberty of their people, in which they resist the Hellenistic forces of Antiochus Epiphanes IV, these terrible stories of the early Jewish martyrs in the second century before Jesus. That's trivialized too, and it's just a commercial opportunity to go by. That's the deep background of what the Supreme Court of the United States has said about these matters. We have, however, no case that directly confronts the issue of whether you can sing carols. And if so, what? Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer? Is that it? ought little Christian children to learn something about the genuine religious significance of Hanukkah? Of what martyrdom means in the face of totalitarian government? Maybe with stories that come right down to Anne Frank? I wouldn't be offended if my child were exposed to that. In fact, that's what I do as a father. I tell them stories about Jewish faith to make sure that they know this stuff. But I wouldn't be offended, let me put it that way, if in the public school curriculum my children were taught something about Jews, any more than I would hope that we can come to a point where Jewish families won't be offended if there's something about Christianity, whether in the form of a song or whatever. But together, all the children say, well, we're now going to celebrate Christmas and the meaning of Christ and everything like this, and we want you to, you know, put Christ back into Christmas. This is, I think, the kind of problem of the Shem case, of the indoctrination of small minds. So some singing of Christmas carols, I think, would be inoffensive myself. Others might disagree on that. But it's all in how you do it.
There's no ruling.
Right. There is no definitive ruling from the Supreme Court, but we're left with these cases to puzzle out what the appropriate would be.
Because I know that when our older children were in school, there used to be what was termed the Christmas program, and everyone came and the choir sang these really deeply religious Christmas carols. Now, that's just unheard of, and so I was wondering if there was some reason why. Not that I think it should be.
It's because people read the implications of these earlier cases in a particular way. And some, frankly, are for stripping the public dimension of life in America of all religious content. They only want secular ideology to prevail. They don't want any discussion about God and his demands. And again, you know, that can be a pretty dangerous kind of society to live in. If civic virtue is predicated on loyalty, Thanksgiving, what are we supposed to be grateful for? George Bush and Danny Quayle and the Congress? give me a break. I mean, there's more to Thanksgiving than that. That if we can't express somehow that we are a nation under God, which is the way the Pledge of Allegiance got amended in the 50s, namely under divine judgment. I don't see that means that because we're under God, that means that we're a better nation than Mexico or Canada or Great Britain or whatever like that. It's not my God is bigger than your God type of thing. It's rather that we're under divine judgment, the way that Abraham Lincoln talked about it in the Sacramento inaugural. Imagine the ACLU or some other group trying to chisel out all the references to religion in the second inaugural of Lincoln, and you get the kind of animosity that is going on about these religious matters. I was told in a talk show, and it's where everything that really matters is decided in Southern California, on a radio talk show. Carol Sobel, the representative for the ACLU, said that she thought that the purpose of the First Amendment was to eliminate the last vestige of religion from American public life. And I go, oh my God. I said, well, Carol, that sounds like something that you're really devout about and really care about in a very ultimate way. But not only is it not in the text, it sounds like something you'd want to do to slavery, not religion. Just remove the last vestiges of an oppressive human force like that. But religion is also an uplifting force. It can be problematic. It can be oppressive. And so we have to, that's why we started out with the concern about established religion. It's terrible for the people who are not members of the established order. So we don't want an established order. But I think we can avoid an established religion without eliminating any possible reference of religion to public life.
I just want to say something about the Pledge of Allegiance in one high school
right.
In Washington. Okay. I used to teach in this school, not a substitute. When I go into an English classroom, every Monday morning, someone leads the Pledge of Allegiance over the PA system.
Mm-hmm.
This is what run room looks like. Everybody stands up, salutes the flag. Another room, nobody stands up. Another mm-hmm. room, two kids stand up, the others hang out like this. Now, that is, and this lady here said, oh, it is required that the children stand up and say the Pledge of Allegiance. I said, it is not required in the state of Washington the children stand up and say the Pledge of Allegiance.
Oh, I see. No, this is a matter of custom in your particular locale.
But it is not required. Joanne, do you have kids stand up and say it?
They do.
They do.
In my district, we're required to have it every day. We have to do the pledge
every day.
And so that's where peer pressure comes in. But in our school, we've tried to keep the Jehovah's Witnesses together in one classroom. If you have three second grades, then they're all in one classroom so that they feel comfortable together. And it has not been a problem in our school. I had the group 2 years ago, and there was never any feeling against them or anything. But mm-hmm. anyone else, it's just assumed that you stand up. But you are required to have a pledge.
That's right. But, I mean, little children stand up.
Yeah,
high school kids don't stand up if they don't feel like it. And teachers say, well, if you ever want to teach disrespect for prayer, require prayer every Monday.
Yep.
Have those high school kids come from an era of no pledge of allegiance? I mean, for example, when they were in the kindergarten, first grade on through, I mean, was that an era, Joyce, can you remember back to when those high school kids were back there, did they not have the pledge?
No, they had the pledge then.
They did then.
Yeah, they've always had the pledge. It's always been required in our district.
It's required to be said, but the teacher doesn't have to say it. Somebody has to say it.
I know of no situation in our district at the elementary level where it's a problem at all. And I'm curious now to see what happens in our secondary schools in our district. I don't know.
I'll tell you the way it really is. That's the way it is.
Well, I can believe it, because it's...
I do really work so hard to teach that respect, and if I see a kid slouching over, I'll just gently go over to them and, kind of stand at attention by them. I teach that respect.
Right.
I've never really thought of it as a prayer, but I am bothered when it comes to the phrase under God. It just, I think there may be some kid in here that...
Why does that bother you to think of our nation as under God?
Well, even my daughter is a senior in high school this year, and she was in the concert choir. And their program was almost all religious music. And in our district, that's very acceptable. But I couldn't help but I saw a lot of, I thought, does everybody here really feel that way? It was beautiful to me, but I was feeling a little uncomfortable for other people.
Uh-huh.
I wouldn't want to, it doesn't seem to be a problem in our community.
Right. Well, along those lines, the Silius case that I got involved in, in the old days of HEW, now it's the Department of Education, the federal level, that went to a Christian college in Florida, we go around inspecting various programs that there's federal money attached to. And it was a humanities building in which a course on music at the college level was being instructed. And the catalog said that they were going to study Bach and Mozart and stuff like this. And so the person who was obviously totally illiterate, had never heard of Bach or Mozart, wanted to see the materials that these students were learning to play instruments to, and saw that sure enough, this was the Passion of St. Matthew or whatever else, one of Mozart's masses, the Requiem or something like this. Said, you can't do that in a federally funded building. You've got to get that stuff out of that building. And that's just the most ludicrous, stupid interpretation of what indoctrination in religion is. I mean, as though Leonard Bernstein, one of the most sensitive Jewish musicians of our century, is going to, A, not compose music himself, that is deeply religious in character, such as the Chesterton songs, which are absolutely exquisite and moving, or B, decide that the New York Philharmonic isn't going to play any religious music. I mean, at some point, the argument really gets silly. And I think...
We're getting close. Yeah. Where they think that 1 hour's religion or 1 hour's baccalaureate influences them. Just think of how many hours of teaching those people have sat through, and it hasn't affected them at all. And yet, 1 hour...
This rabbi's prayer didn't anywhere near take an hour. It was like 2 minutes in the midst of that 1 hour. And as I say, the district judge said, if only he had eliminated the word God, the prayer would be perfectly fine. It just invites these graduates to be respectful about our courts and our system of justice and this, that, and the other thing, and be grateful for their teachers. Well, what, if I may say, in the name of God, is wrong with that?
The teachers are setting themselves up as gods. The courts are setting themselves up as God because
they're trying
to eliminate God with a capital G and put something else in its place because there's a need there.
Well, there is something to be said for the majority in this case that goes back to the earlier decisions, is that when the government does religion, it usually gets botched. Mm-hmm. It usually is a cloak for a political agenda of getting people to be lined up with the current administration. So that's problematic, you know, and maybe it's the local school district's agenda instead of the President of the United States agenda or something like that. And remember that education in America is you know, it's influenced to some extent by federal policy, but by and large, it's very local in character. You know, each town, each village has its own school districts and its own idea of how to do things. And it's influenced to some extent by a State Department of Education. But when it gets right down to it, if you have an honorary school board, they're going to decide to do what they want to do. And teachers will have rights that are secured at the state level so that they can't just fire them, as I had one other case of a teacher, a Christian teacher, who literally brought her Bible to class each day, and she'd unpack her books, and she'd put her Bible there on the table, and never open it, never say, children, I want you to pay attention, I'm going to read to you from 1 Kings now, or whatever else. She just left it there. And occasionally, when people would ask her, you know, where do you get your courage or your integrity? We admire you for, you know, your kind of, it's just as well. I read this book regularly. And she was fired for saying that. And we represented her and said, no way can you, you know, punish a person economically, remove their livelihood from them, for having convictions that are religiously based, any more than you can say a statute is unconstitutional because the people in the legislature who voted for it were influenced by their religious convictions. That's just the logical absurdity of where we've got ourselves now, that an established religion means any kind of contact between religion and politics. And it never meant that, certainly not to Madison. I'll tell you a little quick Jimmy Madison story, is that the Baptists in Virginia, who were delighted about his memorial and remonstrance against Patrick Henry, when it came to 1789 and were choosing their Congress members of the House of Representatives, for the first time, went to him, and he was opposed to a Bill of Rights. He thought that the original Constitution was just fine, didn't need a Bill of Rights, because if you put a Bill of Rights in there, that would assume that that the government had power to do something that wasn't expressly articulated somewhere. So he did not like the idea of a Bill of Rights. And so the Baptists, trying to talk him into it, said, well, we're going to give you 2 days to think this over. You're either going to support our move for a Bill of Rights with the religious freedom right at the top of the parade, or we're going to organize a campaign for your opponent, namely James Monroe. And when James Madison thought about the choice between James Monroe and James Madison, he came down squarely on the side of James Madison. So religion and politics was very much in the experience of the person who wrote the First Amendment and who became the chief articulator and spokesman, that getting the Bill of Rights approved by the first Congress was itself an incredibly difficult task. They were concerned about everything else under the sun, how are we going to pay our bills, this and that. But they didn't care about a Bill of Rights. That was, he kept standing up and saying, wait a minute, I'm going to talk about the Bill of Rights today. Sit down, Madison. We don't want to hear that. We want to do with this other stuff. And it took them months of continually pestering the first Congress before they got it on their agenda and did something with it. And then it went over to the Senate and back and forth. And we eventually got what we got. But to suggest that religion was not part of political life in America is to misunderstand the debate about slavery, the debate about the death penalty, the debate about abolition of slavery, the debate about almost everything that counts, dueling, gambling, the lotteries, all of these things, right down to women's franchise and the civil rights movement. Again, I told you it's kind of a shock to me that I have law students who don't know that Martin Luther King was a preacher. But, you know, that's part of the craziness of what we've been living through.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Okay, not what I think is, the prison says, well, just a little bit is not going to hurt. Well, just a little bit does hurt. I know a teacher who would bring a Bible to school. In a senior literature class, began by teaching the Bible's literature for 3 weeks, now the Bible's literature is taught for 6 weeks. No one has objected to that, except some teachers feel really uneasy about that. But there's the Bible on her desk. Now what about the Buddhist kid who's sitting in their classroom and sees that Bible on the desk every day? Does that little bit infringe on his freedom of religion?
Well,
there's no Buddhist.
I don't know that it ought only to be the Hebrew Bible and the Christian Testament. I think that at the high school level, at least, an appreciation. First of all, I have no trouble with a course. You can't do everything under the sun. You, as a teacher above all, know that. You can't be expected to do calculus while you're doing algebra. And that's just the nature of any curriculum, is you have only so many units to devote to any particular subject. Better if kids understood Russian history while we're doing American history. Better if they understood the history of Alabama when we're doing American history. But you can't do everything. So if the pragmatic decision is that all we can fit in is 3 weeks of study of various aspects about the Bible, it after all is one of the formative books of Western civilization. And to suggest that you can be a literate, well-informed, well-educated citizen of our republic without knowing anything about that, raises a counter question for me, is how do you expect our youngsters to be vivid, informed, intelligent citizens in the Republic if you don't have some instruction about some of the basic bedrock commitments of the society? Now, where you derive them, whether you take them from the Quran or something, I don't know. I'm not going to tell you how to do your curriculum in your school district. But I will simply report the fact that we should not be surprised that such a very, very large percent of the group 18 to 30 do not vote. They don't register. They don't care. They think it's a crock. Politics is useless. And in part, I think it arises from no sense of moral responsibility for the quality of the society we live in. And again, I don't have any easy scapegoat to blame. I think it's a big mistake to blame the public schools for all kinds of societal ills, whether it's racism or sexism or anything, you know, all the large, big social problems of the day, and then the easy scapegoat is to tag it to the public school curriculum or something like that. And that just makes your life as a public school teacher, whether you're temporary or every day, it doesn't matter. It just makes it an impossible burden to bear, and I don't agree with that kind of scapegoating. But on the other hand, I think that there's got to be room for imaginative, creative planning of how to go about a sensitive handling of these issues without violating the Constitution.
No, but I want you to think about one more thing.
Sure.
John Stuart Mill in the Liberty of Thought discussion, remember where he said that we have received opinions, we say, I can change my mind about this, but in matters of religion, we do not change our minds. He said there's something deep down within us that said, I have an open mind, but we do not have an open mind about this. Remember that part?
Yeah, and what conclusion do you draw from that? What conclusion do you draw from that? That if a kid is born into a Catholic family, that he or she ought never to hear about Protestant Christianity?
Well, never. No, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying that as a teacher.
But that's what Mill thought. Mill thought you should never hear about religion. He was anti-religious at the core.